Hello, Internet. This is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, a live stream broadcast I've been doing every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday during the pandemic, as long as I can't travel and play music for a living anymore. I'm also broadcasting on Mondays and Tuesdays. Mondays, I host Pandemic Open Mic Mondays, which anyone with a song, poem, or rant is encouraged to sign up for at davidrovics.com/POMM. Tuesdays, I host Fifth Estate Live, produced by Peter Werby. All of these live stream broadcasts start at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT, every weekday. And you can find them both live and in archived form on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBOO Community Radio, and my own Facebook pages and channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. If you go to davidrovics.com or search on any podcasting platform for the podcast This Week with David Rovics, you can also find these programs in audio form soon after they're broadcast live. Another place you can find the broadcasts, along with lots of free content, as well as content reserved only for patrons, such as my 16-part audio memoir, is at patreon.com/davidrovics. That's also where you can support my various musical and non-musical efforts at Popular Education. Today's guest has been a local institution in radical circles ever since I first moved to Portland, and before then, too. In fact, I can't remember attending a protest in the city of Portland where Seamus wasn't already there before I arrived. Seamus Cook has been organizing within the labor movement and the tenants' rights movement for a long time, and he's an active member of Democratic Socialists of America. He's a regular contributor to Counterpunch and other publications, and his most recent essay is really fantastic, The Capitalist Limits of Police Reform. Seamus Cook, welcome to Discussions with David.
Great Good morning, to have Dave. You. Thanks for having me.
Morning. Appreciate it. And you are actually one of these, I guess, not exactly rare, but not exactly common folks who actually was born and raised in Portland. I know that probably this only applies to less than half of the people I meet in this city, and which tells everybody out there something about how much this city has changed only in the past decade or so. But I just wanted to start by just asking you a bit about your impressions of Portland for your life here. Like, how would you describe the way that the city has changed in your lifetime?
Sure. Well, I'm 40, so I was born and raised here. I went to Franklin High School. And I suppose I like to think of it as, you know, it was a much smaller town back then. It had kind of a towny vibe, and, a lot of folks who were born here will complain about all the changes, and there is, you know, much to be complained about, like the rent crisis, for example, the housing crisis, and whatnot. But I think overall, there's been a lot of good with, you know, folks moving here, and there's in some ways there's more diversity, you know, other ways not. But I think the anytime there's a fresh influx of people, the new ideas come along with it, and I think overall it's been a good thing.
Mm-hmm. The housing crisis, as you mentioned, and of course, this is something that you and I have been involved with, and along with lots of other people in one way or another for a while. But it's really it's become very dramatic, hasn't it? I mean, just in the past 10 years, especially.
Yes.
Would you say? Yeah.
Yeah, well, you could argue that, you know, there was a crescendo reached in, you know, 2016, and around that time, well, before that even, there's just this price gouging phenomenon going on where, you know, huge complexes were being evicted. Almost every day in the news, there was a news story about every tenant at a 50-unit complex got a $1,000 increase. And, you know, they were destroying neighborhoods and families, and it was just, it was so over the top, you know, that something had to be done, you know, effectively. But really, there wasn't really many organizations that were focusing on this. And so a lot of this went under the radar for so long, even though, you know, it's been going on since I was a kid in different communities, you know, in the Black community, first, you know, of all, you know, the North Portland, Northeast Portland, that whole area has been devastated for a long time before this. But really, you know, 2010s, it got generalized and the whole city was impacted at once, seemingly. So seeing that happen, and it's still happening, you know, in different forms, not as extreme, over the top, but like, you know, the landlord industrial complex is, you know, going forward and they're getting their way still.
And part of the reason that it got less outrageous with the $1,000 rent increases and such is because of the formation of Portland Tenants United and some of the reforms that were passed, like the capping rent increases to 10% a year and that sort of thing.
Oh, for sure. You know, it's fascinating. In 2015, when I joined PTU, nobody was talking about rent control. Nobody was, you know, there's been such a longstanding kind of stasis in how tenants' rights were being treated. And it's kind of similar to the labor movement. After a while, you get stuck in your ways and you think only some things are possible. And it can be compared to right now in police reform. You know, until a month ago, we thought nothing was possible. And now suddenly anything's possible, seemingly. And that happened. Seemingly, for sure. But you know, people's imaginations kind of grow very suddenly during these kind of times. And that was the case in 2015, 16, when PTU was really broadcasting these stories and organizing tenants and making demands and, you know, helping get Chloe Udalia elected. And with her was, you know, I still say that what Chloe has done has been so underrated by the left at large, not realizing the profound effects that relocation assistance did, you know, by really, after that was passed, rent increases dropped substantially, evictions dropped substantially. Mm. People who would be homeless were not homeless because they were paid money to move, you know, and that really was.
Let's explain what that is for people who aren't from Portland or even people in Portland who haven't heard that. they have, but they need to.
Yeah. Relocation assistance is basically if your landlord evicts you, either by an eviction or a price increase, your landlord pays for your moving expenses. And it's a substantial chunk of change. But basically, if you know if the landlord causes your living situation to be terminated, they pay for you to move. And the idea is pretty simple. And Portland's is unique in some ways. It was because of the price increase component. It was very unique. And that has since been copied by other cities, actually. So people who would have been homeless otherwise now had money to move and get a new home. And that was really a game changer. Landlords, their behavior changed very quickly. Turns out that landlords are very frugal and don't want to pay this fee. So they keep their tenants. They don't evict them. They don't raise their rent beyond 10%. And that was before there was a statewide law that was passed. But, that was the most radical pro-tenant law in Portland in modern memory, you know, in 40
what
years
was
at least.
The statewide law?
The state law in Oregon that was passed, was it last year, that limits rent increases to 7% plus inflation. So around
they slightly improved on the 10% that Portland passed.
Well, not really. I mean, I guess it's debatable as to what the inflation rate is or how that's judged. That's always a factor, of course. It's similar. It's kind of modeled after the Portland law that was extended to the rest of the state.
You know, this whole question of defunding the police is just so fascinating in the context of what we're talking about in terms of tenants and landlords and the economy of the city. And you made so many eloquent points in your recent piece on Counterpunch, and I just selected a few of them that we could maybe explore further, although there might be some, you know, it's all related to each other, so if there's a little crossover, you know, that's all right. But I want to read the first thing that you wrote that we could flesh out a little bit. The property of the ruling class, their mansions, rental properties, corporations, banks, etc., require force to protect those with nothing. To protect from those with nothing. The police are the first line of defense for the ruling class. And that's, I mean, that just sums so much up, and I just misread the whole thing. But anyway, the the police, don't quote me quoting you, but this gets to the fundamental question that this whole question of police reform is going to inevitably be running into all over the place. The police are not there to protect and serve in the first place. They're there to protect the property of the rich. And I wonder if just... And what is the police budget in Portland? Do you know? Is it what percentage of the budget? It's huge. It's absolutely huge. I didn't even realize how huge it is in its cities across the country. I don't know how I didn't know that.
It's monstrous. I don't know the exact percentage, but I know that Portland, it's one of the higher proportion-wise across the country. So every city has a similar problem in terms of how much money they spend on the police. But Portland is among the higher percentage-wise of these cities. And the quote that you read, like, to me, that does get to the heart of it. If it also makes you think about, like, how have we allowed this country to be run by billionaires who suck up so much resources? And really, part of that is the police. Like, you know, we talk about occupying streets and parks and whatnot. Like, across in the West Hills of Portland, there's gigantic castles owned by very, very rich people. And we could occupy those giant mansions that could house like hundreds of people each. But
that's
we don't.
What I keep waiting for. Why? That's when is that going to happen? When is this? I mean, people talk about the movement being as big as it is, and it's big. You can drive across, like Mike Crenshaw was saying the other day. You drive across Portland, you see people protesting on you know every other block. But in the past few weeks, but when do we actually challenge did the protests reach those residential neighborhoods? Because the protests are not everywhere, that's for sure.
Well, I would argue that most people don't know those neighborhoods even exist. You know, like in most cities, it's similar. Like we have a working class majority area, and then you have like stowed away these very rich neighborhoods where people don't understand just how enormous these mansions are and how much space they take up and how much of the city's resources and over economic activity goes into their pockets, and not having that realization, you kind of limit your sights, you know, you don't realize that, like, even in Portland, like taxing the rich, it's still like a very controversial topic. How is that possible? How do we have such wealth inequality? And still a tiny tax on the rich is a very controversial subject, even after decades of them soaking up all the wealth in the country.
And there was a tax passed recently, right? That was passed by a referendum of voters on taxing the rich a bit more.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. And yes, in Multnomah County, it passed for housing, and it passed easily. Right. And so that hopefully that's a precedent for people whose minds can open up now. Oh, we can do this, because for decades in this city, it's been like, oh, you don't touch that.
Because it turns out that most voters actually don't make more than $150,000 a year. So the idea of taxing people who make more than that doesn't really bother most people too much, I guess. Although it seems like when we talk about these things, we often run across this problem, which to me it seems like perhaps the biggest problem in society, other than the power structure, is our own minds. Because there are so many people who are hoping that they will be one of those people to be making over $150,000 a year, and they don't want to start taxing people that make more than that, because you know then they're going to be voting to tax themselves in a few years once they get successful. And it seems like with the housing, it's the same kind of thing. Like a lot of people are like, well, rent control, we don't want to do that because those landlords have a right to their property, and eventually I'll be a landlord too. I wonder how much do you think that is an obstacle?
I know that's been a problem, and I imagine that it's changing rapidly right now, considering this recession we're entering. No one knows what's going to happen, of course, but to me, it feels like there's a lot of problems going on with the economy, and a lot of those fantasies or even life goals of people who want to, like, and not against anyone who wants to have a good life and be able to afford basic things. You know, that makes sense. And there's not many opportunities in this economy without like having to buy a property and be a landlord. That's become like a working class aspirational thing, is to become a landlord in this city, especially. But I, you know, so there's that. On one hand, there's that your options are limited to have a good retirement. But now I feel like most people are coming to the realization, young people especially, like, wow, there's not a lot of options out there at all for any of us. And that has to be part of what's fueling this current movement is just people, you know, being fed up and, you know, seeing their future being very bleak, being crushed in debt and not having good job opportunities and whatnot. And that all equals an undignified life. You know, and that's a huge part of this movement is like treat people with dignity, you know, and right now they're not feeling it.
And Seamus, I've only been, to one protest in the past couple weeks. I'm ashamed to say, because I have small children and evenings are often when things are happening and it's just not a good time but to go out. But I'm very happy to see lots and lots of other people who are constantly out in the streets. And I imagine you've been out and about a bit in the past few weeks.
Yeah, although, you know, I've been to 4 or 5 protests and talking to people, it's so interesting trying to make sense of what's happening, what direction things are going. You have these brand new groups who few people I know anything about. And, you know, and this happens every time there's a new movement. When new leaders emerge, the old folks are like, who are these people? You know, and what are their motives?
Yeah, with Occupy, so many older people complaining like, yes. Oh, somebody said something that was not, you know, it offended me. Like, oh, what are you going to do? You're going to have to talk to them about it? Like, gosh.
Yeah. And it's good to be like, we should know who the leaders are and what their goals are. And that's important, of course. But this is like a leaderless movement in some ways. You know, it's difficult to wrap your mind around where it's going and how it's happening. And there's just, but ultimately, there's so much energy out there. Like you said, there's protests everywhere in my neighborhood, just on the street corners, people coming together. And there's, you know, every movement has a component of, you know, people tuning in for the first time, engaging. There's really a huge jump in consciousness, people willing to learn, people understand the depth of the issue, you know, and it's always an accident when these things happen. You can't plan for them. You know, this sudden upsurge, no one guessed that this would happen right now. And so that in itself is a good thing, that people are learning and organizing and getting together. What's going to come out of it? That's a whole different story. And that kind of points to the article I wrote recently. Actually today, right now in Salem, they are discussing a variety of measures about police reform. And of course,
that's right. Today there's a special session of the legislature happening in Salem. And yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because that's also, in addition to police reform, they're also talking about the possibility of extending the suspension on evictions. And yes. And as you also wrote in a previous article in Counterpunch, which is also an excellent article in March about the sort of collapsing state of the economy and the bailout and what the possible future is after, you know, when in this process of supposed economic recovery, which you point out may or may not really be happening and may or may not really have happened after 2008 either. And that was also very interesting. But yeah, it's who knows what do you think is going to happen as far as that the Salem meetings, or what are they, any impressions? This legislature meeting.
There's a bunch of good measures being discussed that I doubt they're going to be passed as written. There's going to be some police union watering down of a lot of those reforms. But some of them are really great, and they could have real impacts. You know, one of them, for example, takes some power away from the police union and their grievance process. That would be positive. One reform puts the investigation of police killing into the state's hand. That'd be positive. But again, like all these reforms, you know, the broader context is they're all influenced politically. All the actors involved are still like establishment politicians. And because of that, it could so easy get watered down, and these reforms could so easily just be turned back.
And they, I mean, as far as the police reforms, I assume they will be turned back, because unless they're going to actually do something about the extreme division of wealth that continues to get worse in Oregon and throughout the country, then how can they defund the police? Who's going to evict the tenants?
And that goes back to the core issue about why we have police in the first place. You know, police have always been an integral part of the state machinery. The state machinery exists for a reason. And getting to the bottom of why that machinery exists is so important. And it's not discussed enough.
No. And I love the way you put it in this in your article. The state for the capitalist is like a shell for a hermit crab. Both can survive without their protective armor, but only briefly. That was, I don't know, where you should write songs. If you, I mean, one of my favorite children's books is about a hermit crab. I don't know if you grew up with that one, but it's a great little analogy there.
Well, it is, because if you take the state away, you have the naked rich exposed, and they cannot rule nakedly. They need a repressive apparatus to have their will enforced. A lot of the laws that are passed, they must be enforced by an armed people, the police. And so if that assumption is true, and to me it's very obvious, that's how the society is run, by wealthy people who need an armed force to protect them and to enforce their will, that makes the reforms very complicated. So the police are not only like a part of the state, they are at the foundation of the state. And the rest of the state that we, you know, the parks department, social services and whatnot, that's all extra stuff. You know, that comes like, that's a higher level than the police. The police are down near the roots. And that's why there's so few examples in history under a capitalist society of reforming the police in a way that you look at and say, oh, there's the model. So how come there's no only model?
In terms of, you're actively involved with Democratic Socialists of America and right, DSA, and it's worth mentioning, particularly because obviously there are other models out there other than sort of between cutthroat capitalism and total equality. There's a lot in between, and I mean, one thing I used to spend a lot of time traveling around in Europe and playing music, and there are places in Scandinavia you could just travel for hundreds of miles and in any direction, and you just will not find a single cop anywhere, and they just don't need them. I mean, half the people in Denmark work for the government. I mean, yeah, okay, Copenhagen has some police and there's different, it's a different scene there. But generally, like outside of the big cities, like there's no cops and there's no crime and everybody has enough pretty much by American standards anyway. And, half the people work for the government and they take care of each other. That's what they do. They you ask a Dane, who do you work for? Half the time, literally, they're going to say, their answer is going to be a state agency. And when you ask them what they do for that agency, it's going to have something to do with taking care of people.
Yeah.
It's children or the elderly or drug addicts or whatever, you know. But it's not like that.
That gets to the point of, you know, there's certain European societies that have definitely done a much better job than we have at creating a society, and the state reflects that society. You know, they don't have, you know, it's not perfect there, but what you just said, their society has focused on eliminating or reducing inequality. And as a result, you know, you have less need of police. And that's really, that gets to the heart of things. You have to have a deep restructuring of society in order to have the police that reflects that society. Right now, we have the police that reflect capitalism in 2020, U.S. capitalism. These are the police that the ruling class needs. And they can change their uniform colors and whatnot, and they can have these little reforms, but ultimately it's going to be the same thing.
Yeah. You say in your piece, in nearly every American city, the wealthy have a death grip over city government, and the police are their favorite and most sacred institution, which is reflected in the outrageous amount spent on police and city budgets. I love the phrase, the wealthy have a death grip on city government, because it's absolutely, obviously the case for anybody who's paying attention. But most people don't seem to be, I don't want to, you know, maybe I should be giving more credit to most people. But as far as I can tell, most people don't seem to be aware that the rich are in control necessarily. Or if they are aware, maybe they just feel like nothing can be done about it. We have to be happy with the most insignificant reforms, having more live music in the parks or whatever, more accessible bathrooms for the homeless population. you know, without wondering about why do we have any homeless population at all in the first place, you know, but yeah, we can provide them with running water. I mean, you know, it's, these are the sort of the parameters. So, you know, can we talk about, you know, recruiting more people of color into the police force so they can also beat the members of their own community? You know, this is the scope of the debate. And yet cities like Portland and Seattle and San Francisco have this reputation around the world, including among intelligent left wingers all over Europe and all over the world that I am familiar with. It has these cities have this reputation as being progressive hotspots. And I wonder how do you disentangle that?
Well, so it's complicated. I mean, so first of all, about how the city is undemocratic, I think most people know that instinctually. I think most working people could not tell you where City Hall is, or they've had very little interaction with City Hall. Once you are a property owner, that changes a lot. You have, you know, you realize that you have a self-interest. You know, and typically it's the property taxes question comes into play, and you look at the world a bit differently when you're a homeowner, and you're treated differently too. You know, politicians suddenly like want your opinion, and they want your vote, and they care about you, and they knock on your doors and whatnot. So that's part of the issue here is how voters are perceived, how people are perceived, and how they perceive city council. But even the average homeowner who might care about city politics to some degree, they still don't know anything about it ultimately. You know, like it's a very non-transparent place of government, as is the state of Oregon. Very few people have any understanding of how laws are passed or how that process works. They might know like who the mayor is, but really the institution is very purposely non-democratic. It's not a space that is meant to engage people and get their input and be democratic. And the few times that happens, like recently, for example, was a great example of suddenly people are engaging with city politics because of the movement. So tens of thousands of people for the first time are like, they sent their first email to city council, you know, or they called city council for the first time. And apparently, I mean, this is all anecdotal for the most part. You've heard reports about people are upset because the demand that emerged was cut $50 million from the police. And that was a pretty solid demand, all things considered. And they fell very short of that. And so it's hard to say where the average person considers that a victory or not, what happened. There were some reforms that were passed at the city level. But even with that tidal wave of engagement, of democratic engagement, you didn't get half of what the people wanted, you know? So like, maybe they'll learn from that. Maybe they'll understand like, okay, why wasn't I given a vote on this? Why are there like five commissioners who decide everything? Why do we give five people total power over the city? And it's up to them to either ignore us or listen to us, you know? That right there, it kind of exposes like, this is an inadequate system, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And a little, I don't know if it's called a station break when we're online, but anyway, we are talking with Seamus Cook on Discussions with David, which you can hear live at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT, Wednesday through Friday every week, along with other broadcasts I host at the same time on Mondays and Tuesdays. All of these broadcasts go out live on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KABU Community Radio, and elsewhere, and they're all archived on my YouTube channel and at youtube.com/drovix. On Patreon at patreon.com/DavidRovix and in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. But in terms of local electoral politics, I mean, we do have in Portland one, at least, I would say, a wonderful radical on the city council, Chloe Yu Daly, and then up in Seattle, they've got Yeah, Kashama Sawant, and who is just absolutely wonderful. And I love both of these women, but they don't seem to have a whole lot of counterparts local government. But it does happen now and then that great people get elected, and then they rarely seem to have a majority because of the way the power structure works. But I wonder, is running for office anything that you've considered, or do you have hope in electoral politics, or do you think it's an important part of the mix, or how would you describe the importance of electoral politics in your experience?
Well, it's not for me, but it's very important. You know, there's certain people who have that ability to perform at that level, and who, you know, we all play our role in politics, and the people who feel that they're able to do that, hopefully they're connected to a left movement. That's for me the only way I ever support politicians, really, is that they are actually connected to an active movement and who's demanding radical change. And it doesn't happen enough, unfortunately, which is sad that in 2020 we are stuck with the politics we're stuck with. And that's a reflection of the left organization, that we don't have it together enough, really, to run enough candidates who are connected to a program, who are leading a movement. And just to clarify, I'm more of a passive member of DSA at this moment. I've engaged in different levels in the past, but I'm more involved with PTU right now. But mm-hmm. I'll say that, like, you know, DSA is interesting. In some cities, they have more candidates running than others. But it's such a broad ranging organization politically that it's difficult for them to, like, focus enough and get the consensus around a candidate or slate of candidates to put them forward. But yeah, if, you know, it's not perfect a system, it's hard to engage. It favors the wealthy, you know, so there's that component of it. And what can be achieved under U.S. capitalism using that system is, you know, I'm not somebody who's going to suggest that through that system we can achieve socialism. You know, that's still being debated, and maybe the Bernie Sanders phenomenon have taught some folks some lessons around that, because it seems to a lot of people that his both campaigns were undermined or stolen by the Democrats. So we're in a weird country where we're put in some weird boxes, and trying to formulate a strategy confined in those boxes, I think, has broken lots of brains for people on the left.
Right, because in the sense that people think that they have to engage in only one strategy, or that a sort of multi-pronged strategy is somehow wrong or not politically correct, or whatever it is they're thinking, like in terms of ultimate effectiveness, or I don't know if because oftentimes the problem with electoral politics, it's like if people get engaged with it, then they are assumed to be approving of the way the system works or something, and it's really doesn't need to be that way. I mean, it can just be a strategy among others, I suppose.
Yeah, and or just you know, we have two parties, so you must be a Democrat, and. Mm-hmm. On some level, that makes sense to a lot of people. Well, that's what exists, and so you work with what exists. And you know, it's hard to have that imagination. Well, actually, that's not going to get us to where we need to go. We actually need a new thing. You know, like we're not going to win under in this box. Ultimately.
Because ultimately the Democratic Party has, I mean, this is something also that I don't know how many people are really concretely aware of, the fact that the Democratic Party has a total stranglehold on urban municipal politics in cities across this country. Not every city, but so many cities are totally controlled by the Democratic Party. And yet you see, maybe not and yet, but or maybe as a direct consequence, you see that the wealth gap is increasing dramatically, and the rich keep on getting richer, and so much of their wealth, as you point out in your article, is tied up in real estate speculation and investing in property. And that's trying to work with that party. And how is it that this party is even considered to be the more progressive of the two? Is it just because they're not overtly, openly bigoted? Or like, I mean, because they're certainly not stopping the rich from getting richer and the poor from getting poorer. And in fact, one reason or another, whether it's, not to blame Barack Obama on everything that happened during the 8 years that he was in the White House, but during those 8 years, the stratification of wealth got dramatically worse.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people locally don't understand how the party even works. You know, like they might be a registered Democrat, but they're not invited to any organization discussions in the party. And those who try to get more involved in the party realize that, okay, I'm part of the local committee, the Democrats, and yet I'm not being able to affect the state level Democrats. There's always backroom deals being made by those really pulling the strings. It's a very non-transparent party. It's not engaging the public well at all. And that's because, like, ultimately they are run by the wealthy. That's who they take their marching orders from. In Oregon, we have a supermajority of Democrats running the state, and it is so difficult to get them to do anything progressive. Now that there's the mass movement, they're making moves about police reform that they want to touch. That this was 10,000 miles away from them until this movement started. And suddenly, okay, now we've got your attention.
Portland just a few years ago won the award for the largest number of killings of black men per capita in any city in the United States. And that was many years ago.
Yes, and it's still known that there's deep problems with the Portland police. And that's part of the issue also, is like you have this organization composed of individuals who have very tight solidarity with each other. They have a very conservative right-wing culture amongst themselves. And getting to the root of that is very difficult. So, and that's not even being discussed really. You know, I mean, people are talking about disbanding the police union, which will get us some far along that road. But even after that, you still have a very rough time with, you know, you have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of officers who share a very similar worldview. And that's very different from most of us outside of that, you know, organization.
And as a labor organizer, the concept of the police union has always been a very strange one, isn't it? I mean, these people unionize. These are the people that beat labor organizers and strikers and stop strikes and kick people out of their homes. But they have a union for themselves, which has always been a very strange idea.
They do. And it's, you know, there's a lot of talk in the labor movement about police unions. And it's a controversial subject, which is kind of silly that labor leaders consider them to be part of the labor movement, when really, like, at bottom, the labor movement is for the working class. And the police, they protect the ruling class. So right there's a class difference in these unions that should be acknowledged. And I think a lot of people understand that. The police unions have zero affiliation towards the labor movement at large. They know that they don't need us. They don't need our solidarity. They have the rich to protect them. That's who backs them to the hilt. So they don't need working class people showing up with picket signs and whatnot. They have a different class interest who's got their backs. And that's why there's no affiliation for them, like, you know, emotionally, or they can do fine on their own, and they do fine. They make more money. They have better pensions. As you know, for benefits and wages, they're doing very well without any broader support from the labor movement.
And you know, the way that they manage to appeal to the rich and powerful, and also lots of other people, that they are needed. And it seems like one of the techniques is, as we've seen in recent weeks, is they attack people for taking the streets, which just for marching down the streets, they call that violent or provoking violence. And so they riot against the marchers, the riot cops riot, which is presumably why they're called riot cops, I always figured. But then when people actually do start doing what the police have been basically provoking them to do by tear gassing and beating them, and people start actually destroying property, oftentimes chain stores and police stations and stuff like that, but wherever, whatever property is getting destroyed, then the police leave the scene and let that go on. And then they come back later. And then they say, if you didn't have us, it would be much worse, when actually they're largely the ones who provoked any destruction that happened in the first place, as far as I can tell. But that's a fascinating dynamic. I don't know if you've observed any of that personally in the past few weeks, or in terms of police response to the protests you've seen.
I mean, I think that's a key component here as to why this movement has gotten so much popular support. Because if you remember, when it first started, there was no talk of concessions. in this city or elsewhere, it was just met with brute force. And that brute force typically works, and it quiets down, you know, demonstrations, but this time it backfired, and more people came out, and you had massive rallies and marches all over the country. And you could arguably, a lot of that was in response to this police violence that was so over the top and caught on news cameras, and they attacked journalists all over the place, and this city especially. So I think that has been a key component of this movement, is educating people as to how violent they are against largely peaceful protesters. And even in Portland, after they passed the police reform bill last week, since then, there's been multiple nights of just off-the-hook police violence that seemingly the city council has no power over. Like, this keeps happening. How is this happening?
And the mayor,
happening?
Too. And he's actually, as you point out, the police commissioner. And yet,
yes.
What's he doing?
Well, I think they're just kind of watching and hoping that we don't hold them accountable. City council is accountable for the police. The police is a bureau of the city. And this keeps happening. They stopped tear gassing temporarily. Although the state today has taken up tear gassing also. They might outlaw that in Oregon. But even that, you know, like, they have guns still. there's other ways to inflict violence. So banning a chokehold or banning tear gas, you know, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying, like, it can get your. They're still going to have their way. They're still going to be using violence to get their way, and they can bend and shift according to what's necessary for them to get their way, ultimately.
Yeah, there are many different ways that this can be done, and I think it's one of those other situations that's maybe instructive for people to look to how things work in Europe, because you have the German police, for example, almost never use either actual guns, which they don't carry usually. They almost never use any kind of so-called non-lethal projectiles. They almost never use tear gas, and yet. They can beat the crap out of a whole lot of protesters anyway, you know, with clubs. You know, they have riot gear and they have clubs. I remember in 2007 at the G8 protests, when Rostock, Germany was completely shut down by protests for a week, and the meetings were only able to take place because the delegates were getting around by boat and by helicopter. But the police, many of them got broken bones in the course of the conflict, the physical conflict with protesters in their tens of thousands. And some of the right-wing politicians in Berlin were really upset, and they said the police should be able to carry guns. And the chief of the police union in Berlin said, "We don't want guns. That'll just escalate the conflict."
Well, if you think about it, like, police do a lot of social work in this city. Well, de facto social work, insofar as there's no social workers. So they respond to incidents that really require social workers, but they show up with guns, and automatically anyone who sees a gun is like, oh shit. You know, like, wow, things just got real here because there's guns present now. So that would be a great demand, I think, for this country, like, disarm the police. You know, there's local demands at PSU and elsewhere in the country around that demand, that I think that's a great place to start. You know, but again, those European countries, the UK too, the police there don't often have guns with them. But it's a reflection of that kind of society that they have that we don't have yet. And we have a ways to go politically to get there.
And PSU, do you know the details about that? Because that's worth mentioning. There was a particular incident that led to this call for disarming the police there. I can't remember the details. Do you remember what was that about?
Well,
they kill somebody?
Yes, they did. It was a couple years ago, and the police didn't always have guns at PSU, and they got guns, and this murder happened. And now, of course, there's new calls to disarm the police there. And I'm hoping that they'll be victorious because of the movement. But that was a case in point of this man died needlessly because these police had guns and overreacted. And that happens all the time, all over the place in this country. You give someone a gun, you put them in a situation that's kind of hectic, and they pull out their gun, and that leads to, and of course, they have racist understandings of the world, and they're scared of black people often.
that's and this was another case of a black person. It was a black man who was killed, right?
Yes.
In terms of strike activity, like there's been a whole lot of talk on the internet and some in other forums, but it's very difficult to kind of get an impression of how widespread it is. But there's been quite a few wildcat strikes and also rent strikes going on in different parts of the country. And I don't know how much you've been keeping up on all that kind of stuff, but what are your impressions?
Well, not as much as I should be. I've been hearing anecdotal things here and there. Definitely there's been a surge in the last 3-4 weeks of strike activity across the country. I don't want to get the names wrong. There's a big strike right now in a port in the East Coast. You know, the longshoremen shut stuff down for a day, maybe not a full day. But and this is common in social movements. You have a general activity of the working class, and they feel empowered, and they see protesters winning demands on the streets, and so they want to take that into their union. And these discussions, you know, this is a working class movement, and so that's going to bleed over, and already has very quickly, into organized labor. And when one group sees another group demanding dignity, they want to take that back to their workplace. And often it's the same people who go to the protests and say, "Wow, that was very empowering, and why aren't we doing this at work?" And so that's a great symptom of this is a real social movement happening, where you have all different sectors of society kind of come to life and pay attention and be engaged and, you know, demand better. Like they suddenly realized how bad things were. And so there's a sudden impulse to make things better. And that's all over the place right now. And how long it's going to last, impossible to say. You know, like no one has any idea. You know, the social movements typically are, you know, they don't last forever. But sometimes you enter periods that we may be entering of like a prolonged series of social movements, you know, and that makes sense considering the economies and the shape that it is and this pandemic happening and decades of austerity driving us to this point, a housing crisis. It makes total sense that now would be a good time to consider this being a sustained period of social movement activity. And none of us, most of us who are involved in organizing now don't have the experience with this. This is a whole new era unfolding before us, you know, and back in the day, like, you know, pre-Occupy, I could write articles about diagnosing what's going to happen because it was pretty predictable. You know, things were more predictable then. And now, like, anyone who says they know what's going to happen, they're full of it. So,
but yeah, and that's usually leftist intellectuals pretty much have a 100% record of making predictions incorrectly, right? But it's too hard to predict. It's although one thing that it's really easy to say when you're sitting on top of a powder keg, you know, you can smell the powder, you can see the powder, you know, it's all very clearly a powder keg, but you don't know what's going to be the spark that's going to set it off. And nobody seems to ever know exactly what that's going to be, but it's burning now.
And to me, it's obvious that this movement has changed society, just like Occupy. There was a pre and post Occupy. There was a pre and post Trump election, you know, and now there's a pre and post this movement. There's a whole new layer of people who have a whole new world outlook and who are engaged in politics now. And so, and each time that happens, we're at a higher level. You know, before Occupy happened, we were in the dark ages, a prolonged dark ages of left organizing. And now, like, we're, like, in the Renaissance, you know? Like, there's a lot of stuff happening, DSA and Bernie and this now, and so many people their levels of consciousness are just rising dramatically. It's incredible.
And it's, like, really too early to tell what kind of structures might be coming out of this, if there's going to be sort of organizational structures or methods or organizations or you know, ideas, common ideas on how to organize, kind of like the way with Occupy taking over public spaces or with Tahrir Square, that was a strategy. I wonder where this is going. I mean, we don't know. Obviously, nobody can really predict the future. But I wonder if you take a stab at what you think there's going to be an election in November? Let's ask that one.
I was joking around like months ago that our next president is going to be Obama. And that was just a joke. And the joke was reflective of things are getting so unstable that the elite want some stability desperately.
I've thought about that. Yeah.
He's one of the few people who could deliver that stability.
At least they hope he could. They imagine he could. He seemed to do that before anyway. Yeah, maybe.
Right.
Except that, Occupy and Black Lives Matter both happened during his presidency, right?
Yes. And that was kind of a jokey prediction that seems more likely by the day as things get more and more. It's so ludicrous that our choices in November are Trump and Biden.
Yeah.
I mean, for the majority of Americans, like, how is that possible that these are our choices? And the ruling class knows that discredits the electoral system. They know that those two people cannot channel the energy that is happening right now. And so they're concerned. The country is, I think, much more fragile than most people realize it is. And the ruling class, they're typically more class conscious than we are. And they understand how fragile things are. And this movement right now, I think, exposed a lot of the fragility with city, state, and federal government. You know, Trump was making all these big comments that we're going to send in the military to crush this. Was like, I dare you to send the military in, because once you do that, you have a whole new dynamic of fragility. You know, like the soldiers, yeah. they don't want to be in the streets, and they're not capable of bringing order to, like, they're going to make things worse. You know, once that's a spiraling kind of downward trajectory, which is why we're getting these concessions now, because they realized trying to crush these protests backfired. So now they're playing nice. We're getting carrots instead of sticks. And hoping that will, like, dampen things down and get us back to a new normal. But ultimately, your question about the structure, you know, what structures we could create or what to engage with. You know, I've taught some organizing 101 courses in the past, and there is laws of organizing. And there's only so many organizing people go to the forms that they organizational forms they recognize as being strong. So unions stand to benefit from this. And right now that the strike's happening, existing left organizations, DSA, stands to benefit from this. And other groups, people are joining groups and getting involved. And through that interaction, we'll learn some basic skills in organizing. But ultimately, like, we do need a political party that represents working class people. It cannot be the Democrats. And anyone saying it can, I'm sorry, you are at this point deluded. And if Bernie wasn't the perfect lesson for that, you know, like, Bernie was our shot. If for those who believed in, you know, reforming the Democrats, and that party did everything they could to undermine and destroy his campaign, and they succeeded.
And then at this point, with all that's going on, I'll bet there are major elements within the ruling class who are wishing that Bernie was the nominee for the Democratic Party, because I imagine there are elements of the ruling class who are entirely ready to give up some of their wealth in favor of better, more stability now that they're maybe realizing that they can't just create more and more inequality forever, that eventually there's going to be the need for... Are you hearing that noise too?
No.
Okay, in my own earphones, I'm getting swiped down to reject a spam phone call. Yeah, they could, somebody else could. I don't know why it's coming through the computer, though, but anyway, yeah.
Well, what you just said, I'll say that, you know, there's deeper and deeper divisions emerging from the ruling class, and I agree that I bet there is a section right now that's like, wow, we messed up with Bernie. We should have let Bernie come in, because... Right now, without that, we have a lot of instability in the future. We have very little tactics available to us to engage this growing anger that's present in the majority of the population. And that's going to be a problem for them going forward, and they know it. And it's a problem for us on the left not being organized enough to really take advantage of that at the moment.
Right. Yeah. Here, here. Yes. And it was a problem that they, before there was any kind of a movement on the streets, this was a problem that the ruling class was very well aware of, obviously. And because, I mean, you see there's other things to explain it too, but you see how quickly they reacted to the sort of pandemic in terms of, like, if we're going to shut down society, we have to bail out not only corporations, but regular people. And it, during the Great Depression in the 30s, I believe it took the Roosevelt administration about 3 years before they realized, oh, we better do something about this or we're going to have a revolution.
Well, it's remarkable that they did that. And they, of course, felt they had to, of course. But now, like, that's part of this changing expectation around working people. It's like, oh, they can deliver us, you know, they can help us directly. We should demand more help directly. You know, like, everything's changing so fast. And
right,
the Trump administration, you know, was in part responsible for this, all these new ideas as a result of this $1,200 they gave and maybe more in the very near future. Trump has a self-interest in giving more money to us before the election. You know, he wants to. So, like, if that happens, even out of self-interest, it's going to get people thinking, oh, wow, like, it's my right to demand they take care of me. And that's a dangerous mentality for the ruling class.
Although other aspects of state response to this situation have been kind of, I mean, I'm just astounded at the complete broken nature of the Oregon Employment Department. It's just amazing. Yes. I mean, you know, I've never gotten an answer from, I applied for unemployment under the new pandemic unemployment thing as a gig economy worker. And as I understand it on NPR recently, there are 400,000 unemployed people in Oregon who are actually on the rolls now, who actually somehow managed to get through. And of those, I think 100,000, they said, are gig economy workers, of which 30,000 have gotten responses, which I believe includes getting rejections, which is what I got, a rejection. And then after you get rejected, you're supposed to call them. And yet there's like three numbers and they're all busy all the time. If for people who aren't in a desperate financial situation, it's like comedy. And you go to their website, it's just amazing. Like, how could anybody navigate that website? It's like completely designed to be impossible.
Yes. I think they fired the head of the department, which is, you know, symbolic.
Yeah, right.
It points to much larger problems around, like, who is this state for? If, you know, this is one of your core functions of a state and you can't do it, you failed miserably.
Yeah.
Like, who is the state for? You know, it raises that question.
Yeah, how about, I mean, it's supposed to be that we pay into this thing, right, to get unemployment benefits when we're unemployed. And yet, you would think they would want to make the actual system navigable by somebody who, I mean, yeah, I don't know what, I'm at a complete loss going to this website and trying to figure this stuff out. It's really, and I can't imagine what must it be like for people with less education and less fluency in the English language. I mean, it's just, if I can't navigate it, there's a lot of other people who can't.
And we can't get those numbers either. The state is really bad at, like, what are the effects of this? You know, like, when it comes to, like, evictions and homelessness. The state's so bad at getting those numbers of, okay, because of this policy or this failure, this many people were impacted in this way. Those statistics, like, never come out. So you don't even know, like, the social consequences of this kind of failure that's happening right now.
Right, right. Yeah. What those numbers mean, how meaningful are those numbers possibly when you know that most people who are calling hours, spending hours, and just getting a busy signal, how can you even take those numbers and say that they mean anything?
Right.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, Seamus Cook, somehow or another, the hour passed us by, and it's been a great pleasure talking with you, and we'll get you back to talk about whatever's been going on over the next month or two next time. Assuming the touring and performing doesn't start up again, as I don't expect it to, because I think, unfortunately, this pandemic will be getting worse here in this country.
Yeah, it is right now. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, dude. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Seamus. Hope to see you again soon.
Yeah, thanks.
And thanks for tuning into this conversation with Seamus Cook. You can find this and other discussions with David in archived form in various locations, such as the Discussions with David playlist on youtube.com/drovics, at patreon.com/davidrovics, at soundcloud.com/davidrovics, and on any podcasting platform if you search for the podcast This Week with David Rovics. I have a new album out on Bandcamp, which you can stream for free, called Notes from a Failed State. The music, the live stream broadcasts, and the podcasts are all free, but if you want to support my journalistic and musical efforts, plus have access to some exclusive offerings just for patrons, please join my community-supported art program, or CSA, at davidrovics.com/subscribe or patreon.com/davidrovics. Artists for Rent Control is now set up to start organizing an emergency eviction response team. Please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up. Tomorrow, I'll be going to Salt Lake City, Utah, to talk with journalist Jeremy Harmon about the legacy of Joe Hill, Eamon Hennessy, and other folks who are part of the radical underbelly in that city. Hope to see you again soon here in the Matrix and out on the streets. Don't pay the rent, and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.